Let's start. So in the last class, using the equation motion approach, we introduce this average of LZ operator and average of this small loop creation operator. Using average of these two operators as our classical variable, and then using the equation motion approach and with some approximation, we find the average of these two operators satisfy this kind of classical equation motion. And in the last class, I mentioned that this is the Maxwell equation. So today I will try to show that is indeed a Maxwell equation. And so the idea is the following. So let's look at this phi b. Phi b is a quantity defined on a square. Okay. So we interpret phi b as a flux going through the a square. Okay. So therefore, and we identify this as a magnetic flux. So therefore, we have this phi b, say I j k l equal to a square, a magnetic field. Let's use the curl b, a magnetic field times a normal vector I j k l. So this normal vector of I j k l happen to be the, you know, so this is normal vector of n 1 2 3 4. So for every square we can have a normal vector, but with right hand rule 1 2 3 4. Okay, so we can assume there is a smooth magnetic field. Suppose this magnetic field is almost smooth. So therefore, within a square, this field is almost constant. So therefore, total flux going through a square simply is a component B field in this normal direction times the area of the square, A square. So we can interpret this phi B as that. Okay. EB is a little, phi E is a little bit tricky. Still, we want to view phi E as a flux, as an electric flux. But however, phi E is defined on the link. You know, for every link, we have a phi E. So almost like for the electric flux, it's not like phi B. We can view phi B as a uniformly distributed inside the square. But the phi E is really on the link. So it's like concentrated electric flux. But here I want to smear them out. Okay. The way to smear them out is half. I tried to draw it, but I didn't draw it very successful. So I had to really using your imagination more. So we have a cubic lattice, which is IJKL, you know, as a cubic lattice. In this cubic lattice, we have a dual lattice. The dual lattice is falling. On every cube, we have a center. Then using center of every cube, we can get another lattice, which happened to be also a cubic lattice. So center of a cube form another cubic lattice. So we call this dual lattice. The dual lattice and the original lattice have a connection. That is that's a face in the dual lattice have to cut through a link of original lattice, and they intersect at the middle of the link. And the face also have a size A. Okay. So this is the connection we want to use. That is, although this phi E is defined on the link, we want to smear it over this, the face of the dual lattice. Because every link of the original lattice is correspond to a face in the dual lattice. And then we smear this electric field on the link of original lattice to to the face of a dual lattice. So kind of smeared it out. So using this smeared electric field, so that's motivated us to think this electric field on IEGA is also given by this A square of some kind of electric field dot this NIJ. So NIJ is simply is a, say this is a this unit vector of N 1 2, you know, from 1 to 2. Okay. So because the reason is that when you smear that this flux in the link to the face of a dual lattice, the area of the face also A squared. So when you smear it, so we can say that we have an E field times the area gave us total flux. Okay. So this is the motivation of this continuous variable. So how we associate with some kind of the lattice variable to some kind of smooth field in a continuum limit. Okay. So this basically set up how we make a continuum limit of this discrete equation motion. Okay. And I just want to say that you know, I write this equation motion in some very strange way. I have an explicit index, but I had to interpret it in the following way. Like the phi e is defined on the link, phi b is defined on the center of squares. So this equation really says that the time derivative of the variable on the link depend on some combination of four variable on the nearby squares. So that is a relation. So this is really a lattice relation. So you can do the lattice Fourier transformation to translate these two equations in k-space and find this more accurate equation motion. But here, when we do this, we basically doing a similar thing, but we only consider small k limit. We only consider small k limit. Say, for example, if you do the lattice calculation, you may get the equation motion has this kind of dispersion relation. But however, so this is a k. This is some kind of frequency. But if you do this smooth field approximation, we somehow only consider the small k limit near this k equals 0 neighborhood. We kind of throw away anything for large k. So doing this have a danger that if a lattice calculation shows that this mode actually going down to zero at some zone boundary, then this calculation would miss this mode. And but for this particular case, this doesn't happen. So therefore, this calculation is okay. Yeah, I mean, for this particular equation motion, the zero mode only appear at the k to zero. So assuming k to zero is okay. Okay. So once we set this up, the next calculation will be simple. So let's look at this equation, which is easier. For the second equation, so that term became, say, a squared partial t times bz. So let's assume this 1, 2, 3, 4 is in xy plane. So therefore, this phi b 1, 2, 3, 4 is associated with a z component of a b field. Then we have this coefficient minus j over pi. So what is this four quantity? For this four quantity, we notice that say 1, 2 and 3, 4 have an opposite orientation. So therefore, this n 1, 2 and n 3, 4 just opposite, one in x direction, another in the minus x direction. Okay. So therefore, for e 1, 2, for the phi 1, 2, the e E at this place will enter. But for the 534, the E at that place would enter. But these two E enter with the opposite sign because N have opposite sign. So therefore, basically, the combination of these two basically is a difference of the E, and their separation in spatial direction is A. So therefore, so this combination of 1, 2, and 3, 4 really gave us a minus, actually, I think, partial y and e x times a squared. Okay. So this one is simply just a difference of the e. The difference of E here and here. Okay. Similarly, the combination of 3, 2, and 1, 4, I think gave us a plus A squared partial X E Y times A. And then this A on both sides, A squared cancels out. So this gave us a partial T, the Z component of B field, equal to minus J A over pi. And then we get this curl of the E field in the Z component. So this is a partial X E Y and a partial Y minus partial Y E X. So basically, that's it. So that is that's how we do it. Okay, and we can do the similar thing. You know, the structure of these two is very similar. Actually, if you go to dual lattice, these two lattice equation actually even have the same form. Because on a dual lattice, the link became square. And square became link. So if you go to dual lattice, even at the lattice level, these two equations transform into each other. Okay. So at the end, what we get is this max equation, a partial T equal to 4 pi G times A curl for this B field. And partial T equal to minus J A over pi curl over E. So this is this equation. So we only derive the second one, but the first one you can derive calculate in a very similar fashion. So this is how we get a continuum Maxwell equation from this a lattice version of the Maxwell equation. But there is a problem, actually. And so you say, OK, this is a Maxwell equation, but actually, this is not quite complete. The Maxwell equation have four equations. We only get two of them. You know, the other two equations actually is a divergence of the E equal to 0 and a divergence of B equal to 0. That's another two equation. So there's a question how we get the other two equation. Okay. Well, actually, this is not hard. So to understand the other two equations, so let's consider, I don't have too much space here. I'm using this little bit of space here. Okay. So let's consider the surface integral of the E what is this? Okay. So well, that's not hard to get. So let's try to understand that in a pictorial way. So we have a volume. And this S is the surface of this volume. Okay. So we integrate over the E field on this surface. So basically, we calculate total electric flux going through the surface. Okay. So what is electric flux? You know, from here, we see that electric flux and the lattice model really live on the links, live on the links. Okay. So at the lattice version, we can imagine this area S cross many links. And for every link which cross S, it will contribute electric flux, which is basically phi E. So every link contributes this kind of quantity, or more precisely contribute to this quantity. Every link contributes to that. Okay. However, as we mentioned, that in the closed loop phase, the flux through the link are all conserved. So there's no source, no drain. So therefore, when you do the surface integral, you would get zero. Or more precisely, what you get is a volume. You get is a sums over qi. For I, we go within this surface. You know, qi really, qi is defined here. The qi really is test whether the flux through the link is conserved or not. If qi all equal to zero, you know, we can think this lij as the flux through each link and they are conserved, give us closed loop. Okay. So therefore, the surface integral of this electric field defined here is really the sum over this lij on the surface. But the sum of lij on the surface actually is sum of qi inside the surface. And in the ground state, qi all equal to zero, so this equal to zero. So that's how we get this quantity. So in the ground state, in the closed loop phase, we have no open string. If you have no open string, qi all equal to zero. And then this surface integral of E also equal to zero, so that means E have no divergence. But on the other hand, so this became excitation. If you have open string represents high energy excitation, which causes energy U over there, big energy U. And for such big energy excitation, for one end open string, the qi actually is equal to one. Oh, so there's two pi here, I'm sorry. Because I have two pi in the definition. So this quantity just became two pi times integer. Yes. Yeah. So this became quite interesting now. So we can see that the divergence of electric field or the surface integral of electric field actually tell us the total amount of qi inside of the surface. So really now we can see that the qi can be interpreted as the electric charge. And for our quantization, because we define our electric field in this very special way, our electric charge is quantized as so the more general result is this. The surface integral of the electric charge is quantized as a 2 pi times integer. If it's not equal to zero, it's 2 pi times integer. This is quantized. Okay. So this basically gave us some kind of a hint. What is the electric charge? So you can see the electric charge is end of string. It's where qi is not equal to zero. And that gave us a divergence of this E field. And similarly, we can try to understand what is the y divergence of B field equal to zero. Okay. And so where this relation comes from? You can see the first relation really comes from the quantization of the qi. So qi is quantized as integer. That's very important. Because qi is quantized as integer, either it's zero or non-zero. So in Guangxi it's zero, and then charge is quantized. So this is very important. But for the B field, the reason is totally different. For the B field, then we can look at this, let's look at this cube. Okay. This cube have a six surface, have six squares. Okay. And so we can think about this, this B operator, you know, I, J, K, L. The product of this B operator on these six squares, you know, let me just formally denote this as this. So this quantity represents the product of this B operator on a for the six square on a surface of a cube. So there's a product of a six B operator. What is this? This is equal to one. That is identity. The reason is that from the definition of B operator, this is the definition of B operator. And remember, this Lij is just an e to the I, this rotor model, so theta ji. It's just this. Okay. So when we consider this, the product B operator on a surface square, the orientation taken is like this. Say on this surface orientation, the ijkl is we pick this orientation. So therefore, the normal vector is pointing outwards. For the top, the orientation is picking as this. Again, if you do right-hand rule, the norm is pointing outward. When you consider the product of this 6B operator on the six squares, you can see that this link appear twice. Once appear as edge of this square, another times appear as edge of that square. But in these two cases, they enter in an opposite orientation. So that means this quantity appear twice in this product, but it enter with opposite sign or opposite orientation, and they cancel out. Actually, for every quantity on link, they all cancel out. So therefore, we have this operator identity that this quantity equal to one. Okay. Then from the average, you know, now you can see that this phi b actually is a phase of the average of the b operator. If the product of this b operator equal to one, that means the sum of phi b, I j k l, on this on the six square on the surface of cube should equal to zero. So that the phase, your other phase equal to zero, so the product equal to one. But that's not quite true. It's a zero mod 2 pi, to be more precise. Because you only require the product equal to, product phase equal to, phase equal to one. Oh, sorry, the product e to the I theta equal to one means the theta is a zero mod 2 pi. So the other of a phase is really zero mod 2 pi. Okay. And actually, this is a integration of a B field on the region. So integration of B field on the region really can be divided into the integration of a B field on the surface of many small cubes. So and each small cube gave you a contribution zero mod 2 pi So whole thing gave you 2 pi times integer. Again, 2 pi times integer. Okay. So this is a this is a monopole. You know, if it's a 0, then you have a no monopole. But you could have an extension where the integration, the surface integral, is not 0. It's a 2 pi. So you can get a monopole. So we'll go back to monopole more carefully because we have pretty pictorial understanding of a charge. But the monopole seems is a little bit indirect. But we'll come back to this later. And here I want to make a point is that that's why I use curl E and curl B, not use E and B, really because this curl E and curl B is not quite a standard definition of electric field and a magnetic field. And it's obvious from this quantization condition. For this particular choice, in our definition, the electric charge is quantized as 2 pi and the magnetic charge is quantized as 2 pi. And this is the most natural choice of E and B, actually. So I call this a canonical choice. The both electric field, electric charge and the magnetic charge is quantized as 2 pi. And so this is this is very natural. Okay. So now let's just go through this canonical formulation a little bit more. And the energy actually is equal to this A times J over 4 pi square E square plus G B square. Again, I'm using these two. And the relation I just erased. I shouldn't erase that. Okay. So so basically, this E squared term really comes from, well, I make a mistake here. It really comes from this J term, this LZ squared. LZ is basically the phi E squared. And the phi E squared gave us E squared. And this term really gave us two times the cosine phi E, I, J, K, L. If phi E is small, or phi B is small, that gave us a 2 minus 2 minus 1 phi B, I, J, K, L square. So if you expand the cosine to the second order, we just get the phi B square. So, so this term gave us phi B square, which gave us a B square term. So if you include all these coefficients, you get something like that. And so another thing I like to say is that from this equation we can find the following. We find this partial t squared e is equal to this minus 4t. I think it's J, A square. Okay. So you just apply another time derivative, then you get the time derivative of B, then you apply this equation again, you get the equation only for E. The reason I write down here is that from here, you can get the speed of light. This quantity is a C square. So we find the speed of the propagation is actually the square root of is a 2 times a square root of jt. Okay. So that's how we get the speed of propagation. So you can see that the geometrical mean of these two quantities, both have a dimension of energy. The geometrical mean of these two quantities determine the speed of speed of lights. Okay. And using this speed of light, we can write we can write this energy in the following way. This energy is a C over 4 pi. Then there's a alpha C E squared plus 1 over alpha C B squared. So we get the energy of this. And these two equation motion also became simple. And these two equation motion became this 1 over C. 1 over C, and this is 1 over alpha C, and minus alpha C. Where alpha C is another quantity. It's a square root of it's 1 over 2 pi, square root of J over G. Okay. So this is speed of light. Okay. And this is energy. And this is a Maxwell equation. So this is kind of a canonical formulation of the Maxwell equation. Yes.
Whether we assumed that J is a lot bigger than G or G.
Yes, we assume J much smaller than G.
Okay. Yeah. So alpha is small.
That's right. Exactly. That's why I write R. So here we assume that J is much smaller than G. And this validity of this approach requires J much smaller than G. So that's a precise reason why I write this. And in the alpha actually equal to I think it's this relation. The standard definition of alpha, the fine structure constant, is twice of this alpha c. So basically, the two are roughly the same. Okay. And but alpha c is much more convenient, really, because of Pauling. First, in this definition of electric field and magnetic field, the both electric charge and the magnetic charge quantize the same thing. It's 2 pi, quantize 2 pi. They have same quantization. And from here, we can also see that if we exchange the E and the B, then the alpha C would reverse. That's duality. Exchange between E and the B, and alpha C, not alpha, it's alpha C get reversed. And then the whole theory have this do not change this form. Yes.
Quantization is equivalent to the normal quantization of electric charge. What size do you get for the lattice spacing? What size do you get for the lattice spacing if you assume that this is equivalent to the normal quantization of electric charge?
Electric charge, so this is one thing. From this quantization of electric charge, we cannot refer to lattice space. And so that's one thing I really have to emphasize. We always say electric charge is quantized, which is a very misleading thing to say. In some sense, yes, electric charge is quantized, but electric charge is integer. I try to say electric charge is an integer, not E. So what is an E? E actually is a coupling constant. It's much better to write your theory as a to say that E always equal to 1. But then the coefficient in front of E squared term, or maybe more generally, this F nu nu, this one, you have some kind of coupling constant G here. So, but usually what people do is that they rescale the electric field to make G equal to 1, then this E not equal to G. You know, and that is a little bit misleading, you know. And so the because of that, people say when you do this Feynman diagram calculation, electric charge gets renormalized, you know, from E to E star, you know. But that is a very misleading way to understand the gauge theory. Electric charge is always integers, can never get renormalized. It is this coupling constant, this coefficient in front of F squared term can be renormalized. Okay. So here I try to introduce this curl E, curl B, whose definition is that the electric charge and the magnetic charge are both quantized as 2 pi. So that's making them consistent. So the charge can never renormalize, always 2 pi. But however, the dynamics of the coupling constant is alpha c. This will determine the dynamical property for electromagnetism. It's an alpha, the fine structure constant. And for our electric field, electromagnetism, the alpha fine structure constant is like 137. So it's very small. But in this model, the real meaningful quantity is really the fine structure constant, which is the ratio of J over E. That is J over E. And then, so actually this is consistent with this equation motion approach. We start with this small j limit. Remember, we start with small j limit, where this quantity, this phase is pretty classical. When j equals 0, this phase became totally classical. But for small j, this phase is still less weak fluctuation, is more or less classical. And then we notice that's very nice. The small j limit corresponds to the small fine structure constant limit. So it is because fine structure constant is very small, we have this semi-classical picture. And this is a very important realization because we know that in another limit, if a j is much bigger than g, we get different phase actually. We don't even get this gapless phase. You know, this phase have a gapless excitation. But if g equals 0, j is finite, that's another limit. The ground state is similar just LZ equals 0 everywhere. So anytime you make LZ not equal to 0, you cause energy J. And you have a gap. And this is called a confinement phase. And so there's confinement. And in the J much bigger than G, we get a confinement. And but when G much bigger than J, we get this Coulomb phase. We have a Coulomb interaction between charges. Now with this understanding, we can say maybe the confinement deconfinement transition is characterized by alpha c. When alpha c is order 1, we get that transition. So the transition really, so we get to this electromagnetic phase or this Coulomb phase only when alpha c is very small. Yeah. Okay.
Here you have a relation between quantization of your electric charge and the magnetic charge.
Right? Not really. In this definition, they just. They both quantize as 2 pi. So here I choose, usually people say that the electric charge and magnetic charge quantize are one inverse of each other. But that's true, but on the other hand, if I choose a convention that electric charge always quantize as 1, the magnetic charge also quantize as 1. So they have same quantization condition. I try to emphasize that this electric charge and magnetic charge are inverse to each other, it's a fake. It's not important. It's just a normalization condition of the how you choose normalization of E field. Yes. You can choose the normalization of E and the B field to make both equal to 1. And that's a much more natural choice. Then the dynamics, that's why I introduced it. Then the dynamics of the E and the B field is indeed characterized by a real number. This is the alpha. So actually how alpha enter in this new formulation is this one. One is alpha c, that's 1 over alpha c. That's how they enter. And the speed of light enters here. There's a c here. But the speed of light, you can see, even speed of light is not important because speed of light is just an overall scale of energy, you know. So the real dynamical, what makes the dynamics different, it is alpha c making them dynamic difference. But on the other hand, you will see the different dynamics only include this, only you include this quantization condition for electric field and electric charge and magnetic charge. Because electric charge and magnetic charge are quantized. Because of that, you have the meaningful alpha c. Yeah. Okay. So this is basically the electric charge and the magnetic charge. And in this form, and also the importance of fine structure constant. So from here, we basically say that at least in this loop model, when the fine structure constant approach to one, we experience the confinement decompinement transition. So for deconfinement phase, actually, they're pretty simple. For the confinement phase, also pretty simple. Is that in the confinement phase, basically the ground state is no string states. When we create a string, then the string would have energy due to the string tension. So the energy of a single string would depend on how long string is. You know, here for every segment you have a contribution of j. If n segment would be n times j, that's energy of string. But what is string? When you have an open string, the two end of a string is a charge. So this energy, this linear energy dependent open string can be viewed as we have a charge E and a minus E. They are separated by L. The energy of the two charge is proportional to their linear separation. So that's why we also call that confinement. So in the Coulomb phase, when you have a charge E and a minus E, two opposite electric charge, the energy between two charge actually is 1 over R, and which you have to calculate using this Gauss's law and this energy expression. You can show it's 1 over R. But however, in the confinement phase, the energy between two charges are linear, have linear potential. So that's why it's called confinement phase. So therefore, in this model, not only gave us this electromagnetic field, it also gave us a physics of a confinement and deconfinement transition. When J much bigger than G, we're in the confinement phase. When G much bigger than J, it's a deconfinement phase. But so through this model, you can study what is the nature of the confinement decompinement transition, which is at least for this model, we don't know exactly how to do that. You know, the formulas I developed here only for J much less than G, so deep into deconfinement phase, or deep into confinement phase when J much bigger than G, we also know. But when J about equal to G, then we don't know too much about this model. Yes.
This model could also be used for strong interactions.
Yes, actually. Okay, but the meaning is a little bit different. Okay, yeah, you raise a very very good question. So let me address this issue. So here, this model gave us this electromagnetic interaction. And people usually say electromagnetic interaction is not confined, which is true, which means you have a phase which is deconfined. But however, when you're tuning the parameter, like when you're increasing the fine structure constant, you may drive the phase transition. So here, basically, this is not obvious from the field theory. You know, from field theory, alpha can be anything. But however, when you think about the lattice regulation of the field theory, you will see that when alpha is much bigger than 1, the deconfinement phase becomes self-inconsistent. Actually, the model should be in the confinement phase. So this is a phase transition by tuning the short distance parameter like alpha. However, for strong interaction is very different. For strong interaction in three spatial dimensions, we only have a one phase, confined phase, which really means that you can do the semi-classical approximation like we did here. There is a model gave us SU3 actually. Then you'll find that you have a deconfined phase. You have non-Abelian Maxwell equation. But then the difference is that for strong interaction, the quantum fluctuation is important. Actually, the quantum fluctuation drive the deconfinement phase always to the confinement phase. So therefore, if you have a similar model for SU3, you only have one phase confinement phase. Only for the U1, you have a two phase, depending on lattice parameter, confined or deconfinement phase. So therefore, the confinement of the SU3 gauge field in lattice model almost like trivial statement. You're always in the confined phase. There's no non-trivial phase, actually. Actually, in four spatial dimension, the non-abelian abelian be similar. In the four spatial dimension, the even non-abelian gauge field can have a deconfined phase. Then you can have a, by tuning the lattice parameter, you can have a phase transition of confined, deconfined phase transition, even for non-abelian case. But for three spatial dimension, is for non-abelian case, you only have a confined phase. So that's a little bit different. In the last, let me just give us some kind of intuitive understanding, some kind of more intuitive or more pictorial understanding, what is a magnetic monopole? Okay. So for here, I just want to say the following. Remember the ground states. The ground state is sum over all loops. But Hilbert amplitude is always equal to 1 here. Okay. But however, for the excited states, then we have amplitude which is not equal to 1. Again, we have a sum over loops. But we may modify the amplitude, not always equal to 1. So then we get some excited state. That's very simple. And so actually, this is the framework I want to study. Because when you have a magnetic monopole, we don't have electric charge. It means the state have no open strings, all closed strings. So therefore, the magnetic monopole correspond to excitation, which we only have loops, but we just modify the amplitude wave function to create excitation. That's how we get the monopole, because no charge. But how we modify this phase to so that we can get a monopole? And then the idea is the following. You know, the wave function for the loop plus a small square divided by the wave function for the loop without this small square, it's basically it's e to the I phi b of this small square. Because of the following, you can see when we apply the b operator to this wave function, we get this wave function. And we know that the average B operator is this phase. So that means the amplitude on these two bases, they differ by a phase. If this ratio always equal to 1, that means the wave function always equal to 1. So we are in this case. That where here, that B operator always equal to 1. So only when this ratio give us a phase, and this phase happened to be the phase of the B operator. So that's one thing. And we can generalize this a little bit. Suppose we have a wave function like this, a string like this. If you modify the string by a square, only by a square, again, these two are different by a B operator. So again, this is this phase. And this is very important. So therefore, means if you have a string configuration, if you deform a string a little bit, the phase of wave function will change by a flux of this deformed area. You know, you deform a string a little bit from here to here. Then in the deformed region, you have magnetic flux going through that. And this magnetic flux going through that will tell you the phase difference between these two wave functions. This is essentially how we define the B operator, because B operator is this way. That means, so the fact that we say the B operator is equal to this really means the wave function have this property. When the wave function have this property, that means the B operator have this form. Now from here, with this understanding, then we can understand magnetic monopole very easily. Suppose we have some string configuration, okay, with a monopole here. Then what we do with that, we create a little bit of string here. We just create a small loop of a string. okay? When you create a small loop string with a very tiny area, again, the phase don't change because flux through this small loop is very small. And then we kind of change the phase of the string, change the shape of the string and make it bigger and bigger, then wrap around the monopole, then shrink them back. So now you can see that this string would sweep a surface, which is a sphere, which encloses the monopole. And the total flux through this surface swept by the string is magnetic charge times 2 pi. Okay, so that's it. So therefore, a monopole means that we have a special, the phase of wave function such that when the string swept around the monopoles, the wave function of the string changed by 2 pi. This is very similar to the vortex. Just remember, in the superfluid, we have very similar situation. In the superfluid, we have a wave function of a particle, which may depend on the arbitrary position of a particle. But a vortex is such a wave function that if you move one particle, we fix other particles' position. If you move one particle around the vortex like that, then the wave function would change by 2 pi if you move only one particle around the vortex. That's a vortex superfluid. And the monopole in a string liquid is that it's such a wave function that if you swap a string around the monopoles, then the wave function is 2 pi. So that's why I try to say that the monopole in a string liquid is very similar to the vortex in a superfluid, the same type of excitation. We modify the phase of a wave function, and then that's create excitation. And however, the electric charge in a string liquid have no correspondence in a superfluid case, because electric charge is the end of a string. We don't have such type of excitation in the particle condensed case. And but the monopole is very similar to the vortex. Yes.
Sure that you take phi b on the small square to be necessarily the smallest possible. We could always add 2 pi to one tiny square.
Yeah, but 2 pi, yeah.
So it's always the smallest possible place.
Yeah, here is we have to pick a gauge. That's a little bit. Because the phi defines more 2 pi. So when we do this linearized expansion, we assume that everywhere the phi is close to zero. Phi b is close to zero. So we linearize the system. So therefore, you have a very good point. That is, so the total phase through each small square is always close to zero, which is the same thing as close to pi. But when it's close to pi, we make them close to zero. And then that's make a choose certain branches, you know, this multiple choice. We choose near zero. The main thing is that when you add all the small square around the monopoles, this sum of this many quantity are close to zero gave us something near 2 pi or 4 pi, you know. And that's what gave us this magnetic monopole. Yeah. So this basically is a monopole. Okay. And that's basically finish our story about this emergence of a electromagnetic theory from the rotor model. However, there is one question we haven't addressed. What is the statistics of the charge? What is statistics of the monopole? You know, you say that this is a maybe I say this has to be boson. Why? Because this is this rotor model is basically a bosonic model, you know. It's a some kind of bosonic model on the lattice, you know, some spin model on the lattice, basically. That's a bosonic model. So when you have a bosonic model, there's no Grassmann field here. Everything is a scalar field, even on the lattice, actually scalar field theory on the lattice. But somehow the emergent theory have a vector field. But then, if, since it's a model based on this bosonic model, so one may think this electric charge and the magnetic charge here may be bosons. But actually, that's not correct. The reason is following. Indeed, we have bosonic model. But however, so that means the open string is a boson. The open string is a boson. Because what is open string? Open string gets a many flip spin. You know, from m equal to 0, we flip to m equal to 1. And such spin flip is a bosonic. So when you flip a spin along a line, that's like we have a component, we have a bound state of many bosons, many spin flip, many bosons. So therefore, this a segment of open string, that's always a boson. This is always a boson, no question about that. But then there's a funny thing that a second open string corresponds to two charge. So we have proof, two electric charge must be boson. But that leaves an opening. What about the one electric charge? If two electrons must be boson, one of them could be fermion. So fermion still consistent. So that's a thing I want to leave you question. In the next tomorrow, we'll study some other models, maybe simpler models, and using those models, we'll address this issue about what is the statistics for end of string. We will show that sometimes end string can be boson, sometimes end string can be fermion. Yeah. Okay, I'll stop here.